The problem is, you do see a lot of antisocial people succeed. Loneliness is as big a risk factor for ill health and death.
You know, we live inside our heads.
You go cold turkey, you go into withdrawal.
There is a lot of value in the stuff that we struggle with.
Better Thinking. Conversations with experts exploring all things psychology.
Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name is Nish Nikolic, and my guest today is Professor Jayashree Kulkarni from Monash University, who's here to discuss her research on the associations between mental health conditions such as depression with premenstrual cycles, most notably premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD, and premenstrual exacerbation, PME. Professor Kulkarni commenced her appointment as Professor of Psychiatry at the Alfred and Monash University in 2002. She founded and directs a large psychiatric research group, the Monash Alfred Psychiatry Research Centre, which expanded from 25 personnel in 2002 to 185 staff and students in 2015, covering seven different research streams and conducting over 110 clinical trials. The aim of the research centre is to develop new treatments, new understanding, and new service deliveries for people with mental illness. Professor Kulkarni graduated from Monash Medical School in Melbourne in 1981, worked in emergency medicine, and then decided to become a psychiatrist. She became a fellow of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists in 1989, and was awarded a PhD from Monash University in 1997 for her thesis, Women and Psychosis. She's worked in this area for 25 years to improve the quality of care for women with mental illness and developed specific treatments that are tailored to suit women's needs biologically, socially, and psychologically. In 2015, Professor Kulkarni founded the Australian Consortium for Women's Mental Health. She's also the president of the International Association for Women's Health, a role she commenced in 2017 at the IAWMH Congress in Dublin in Ireland. Professor Kulkarni has a wealth of experience in the field of women's health, and it's an absolute pleasure to have her here to talk today about premenstrual cycle conditions such as PMDD and PME, something that I wasn't aware of before speaking with her. Enjoy. Jayashree, a big thank you for coming on to the program today.
Great pleasure. Thank you for having me on board, Nish.
Look, I'm quite excited to pick your brain, have a conversation and talk about this premenstrual syndrome space that obviously is something that you're well-versed on. And as I was explaining a moment ago, it's something that I have very little understanding or context of. And I think part of this podcast is to provide myself with plenty of learning opportunities, but also for others to find out more about, you know, the world of mental health. And this is certainly one that I haven't come across, not certainly in the detail that hopefully we're going to talk about today. So I do appreciate our opportunity to talk today.
Fabulous. And of course, the difficulty would be to get me to stop talking about it, because I'm very keen that we get the word out there.
Look, and that's the idea. So I'll certainly be giving you most of the microphone. And let's maybe start with a little bit about what is premenstrual syndrome, and how did you come about to be, you know, researching this topic?
So the terminology's changed quite a bit, and premenstrual syndrome, if you excuse me, Nash, is a little bit old-fashioned.
Wonderful.
So it's PMS was something that people talked about in the 70s and the 80s. And so now when people talk about PMS, premenstrual syndrome, they're really referring to the somewhat minor discomfort or physical symptoms that many, many women, and it's estimated it's about 80%, of women of reproductive age experience. But it's the physical symptoms. It's the bloating, it's the increase in headaches, it's the minor irritability and fluid retention and therefore weight gain that many women have. And it's uncomfortable, but it's not a particularly debilitating situation. The other two conditions that are part of this spectrum are premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD, which affects about 12 to 25% of reproductive age group of women. And this other condition that's more recently been coined, PME, which is premenstrual exacerbation of an underlying mental ill health condition. So I'll go into detail about the latter two. The first one, I think we can comfortably kind of put it into the realm of physical health problems that many women deal with through exercise, through vitamins. So this is where the vitamin B6 group and B1 and some of the other minor lifestyle changes can actually make a difference. But most women don't really experience particular life-altering problems with that. However,
PMS is not an umbrella under which the other two exist, but rather a different category. PMS is the minor discomfort that 80% of women, reproductive women, experience.
Yes.
Versus the PMDD and the PME are separate categories. And that's, I suppose, where this has come about. And so, yeah, wonderful, wonderful. I'm already learning something.
So PMDD, if we turn our attention to that, this is premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Now, dysphoric disorder, again, is a little bit of a misnomer, because this is actually a full-on major depression that some women, and as I said, it goes from about 12 to 25% of reproductive age group women, experience a full blast of incapacitating, debilitating depression that comes on once a month, usually in the low estrogen phase of the cycle, which is just prior to menstruation. Now, this condition presents like that, and I'm clicking my fingers because women will describe they're fine, 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 and then suddenly they crash. And they crash with rage. They can experience uncontrollable rage with very little precipitating factors for that. They can experience brain fog, which can be to the point where, I've had women who say, I can't remember, where I'm supposed to be. I do my job, high-powered job really well for most of the month, and all of a sudden I can't remember what my password is or how to turn on the computer, or just basic things go missing in terms of cognitive functioning or brain thinking, as well as tearfulness and this awful loss of energy to the point where some people can't even get out of bed. So that can go on for about 7 to 10 days in the week preceding menstruation. And then just as suddenly as it came on, it suddenly disappears. So as the woman starts to have a menstrual bleed, either by day one or day two of a period, suddenly there's another clicking of the fingers type of action and this depression disappears and she's back to normal. So this is a very perplexing condition that has been misunderstood for ages and ages and ages, because it seems quite remarkable that, here's a young, not necessarily young, but, the 20s, 30s and 40s year old woman who every now and again just becomes debilitated. And so the common things that have happened that are really invalidating is sometimes people get, they're sort of put down by others. And like, you're making this up, how can you go from being absolutely fine to being so disabled with your depression? Are you putting this on? Or they can get misdiagnosed as rapid cycling bipolar disorder. And the common mistake that's made here is that clinicians have seen the sudden descent into depression and then the sudden ascent back up into normal. But often, after a while, women have learned to compensate. So what she does is in the part of the month or the cycle where she's good, okay, she'll run around doing twice as much, knowing that there's going to be this time out where she can't do stuff. And so to the uninformed observer, that looks a bit manic in some part of it. And then very depressed. And that's where the rapid cycling bipolar disorder diagnosis has come about, which is tragic in some ways because it's missing the point here. And the point is that this is a depression that is created by, caused by gonadal hormone shifts in the brain. The gonadal hormones are estrogen and progesterone and testosterone, and all of the precursor hormones that go to making them. Now, these hormones are produced in women in the ovaries predominantly. They can also, estrogen is also produced in adipose or fat tissue, and a little bit is produced in other parts of the body, but mostly it's produced in the ovaries. But the hormones that control it are in the brain, and they are in the pituitary gland and the hypothalamus. So you've got central brain controlling these hormones. And some women are really vulnerable to the shifts in these hormone levels in the brain. So the hormone levels fluctuate across the cycle. That's why there is a cycle. There are times of the cycle when the estrogen is low, and there are times when it's high. And that's under control of the brain hormones. And for some women, even small changes in estrogen in particular can set off a cascade of the brain chemicals that you and I are very familiar with, you know, the ones that control behavior and cognition and memory and mood. And that can then stimulate the onset of a mood disorder like the depression. So we must never forget that these hormones, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, are potent brain steroids or neurosteroids. They really do have huge effects across the whole of the brain. And it's only been in more recent times that this has become better understood. You know, it's always been a bit weird that we've practiced mental health without thinking about the body as much. You know, we've gone straight for what are the environmental effects that are upsetting this woman, or what are the particular, perhaps early life stresses that are now rearing their head. You know, they're important, I'm not saying they're not, but there's another factor in here that is at play. So that's what's behind PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And it took a long time for this category to be included in the DSM classification system, which is the American classification system of mental ill health conditions or mental illnesses. And for a long, long time, there was great resistance to including it. But finally, it has been included, but not with the full title that it deserves, which is that this is a major depression, but with a dysphoric disorder, dysphoria meaning sadness. So in many times in the clinic here, I'm told by the women very clear story of the fact that once a month there is this crushing despair with suicidal ideation and with suicide attempts and, in the worst cases, completed suicide. So it's not a minor condition that we should just kind of relegate to the backwaters, but it is also important to recognize that the textbook description of a menstrual cycle, and it's a, you know, you see the graphs in textbooks, show that women have a 28-day cycle with ovulation at day 14 and a period that lasts about 4 days, beginning at about, you know, day 24. And so it's all lovely and neat in the textbooks. Well, you know, in reality, that's not how real women operate. So I think we need to be a little bit more flexible when we're working with real world women to say, you know, if she notices that she has a clear sudden onset of a depression and a clear sudden offset of a depression, it may not exactly correlate with a 28-day cycle. It might be a 35-day or even longer cycle, but it's this sudden onset. And I've had many women who click their fingers and go, you know, it comes on like this, or I'm fine one evening and the next morning, you know, it's just like I'm a different person.
How often is it for those 12 to 25% of women with PMDD, how often do those 7 to 10 days occur? Is it every month? Is it most months? I know it's going to be individually,
yes,
potentially different.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm assuming so. But is it majority of the time? How does it usually play out in your experience? What have you seen?
I usually see women explain to me that they have something of the depression that comes on suddenly about every month. The intensity of it can vary. So one month is really bad and can't get out of bed. The next month is bad but can get out of bed. But it's always, I think, we listen for the sudden onset, because you and I know that's not how somebody who's got a major depression, that's not how it happens. It happens gradually, and it continues, the depression just continues to drag the poor woman down. Whereas this is sudden onset and sudden offset. But it may not happen exactly the same every month, although a lot of women tell me they get very good at noticing the same pattern of onset and offset. But I would suggest that for the women listening in or the clinicians listening in, that look for that sudden onset and sudden offset. That's telling. It's also telling that there's something of a biological switch going on here. Because, of course, yes, she's got, you know, stresses in her life, of stress of relationships, stress at work, stress of raising kids, stress of just being alive in the 21st century. I mean, there's all these stresses that are ongoing. But she's coping with it until she gets to this time of the month, and then all of a sudden she's not coping with it. So that makes us, you know, we have to stop and think then, well, what's going on here? Because, you know, it's not like suddenly everything has deteriorated in this woman's life. So that is PMDD. The treatment of PMDD is very interesting, because the more and more we've recognized the hormone causality of it, the more and more obvious it has become that we should be looking at a hormone treatment. As one of my patients said, isn't that bleeding obvious, that if it's a hormone cause, then, you know, use a hormone treatment. And I agree with her that, yes, it's bleeding obvious, but that hasn't been the case. So unfortunately, what has happened in all the guidelines is that the treatments that are still recommended are the SSRI antidepressants, the most common antidepressants that are around. And they're not wrong in terms of treating this, but they kind of don't hit the full causality of it. And so many times women go on to antidepressants and they tell me that, well, it sort of made it a bit better, but I can still feel it. Every cycle there is this depression that's got worse, but it's just kind of masking it a bit. But the difficulty here is then she will go on to describe all the side effects that she's experiencing with the SSRI antidepressant. So here we have someone now who's got partial treatment, but side effects from the SSRI. So we haven't really hit the spot or done the job properly in terms of treating this particular form of depression. So what does work? Well, going back to the common sense approach, which is, well, why don't you use a hormone strategy? We have been working with the hormone strategy, and the first line treatment that we use is an oral contraceptive pill, because it seems obvious, you know, that if the cycle is the problem, then perhaps eradicating the cycle or flattening the peaks and troughs of the hormone fluctuations might be a good idea. Now, here's the other problem that we've had, because some of the oral contraceptives on the market are really potently causing depression because of the type of synthetic progesterones that are in the oral contraceptive. So many women experience depression de novo, just out of the blue, when they start a new type of pill. And we talk about the pill as if it's one thing. That's not the same. They're all very different. They all have different estrogens. They all have different progesterones. And sometimes they don't even have the estrogen, and they're the worst form. That's the mini pill or the IUD that has progesterone. That can cause depression on its own. So after a lengthy amount of work, we've kind of got the league ladder of what's the best pill and what's the worst. And the best one that's on the market is called Zoely, Z-O-E-L-Y. And it's unfortunately not on the PBS, so it's more expensive, but it's the Rolls-Royce of pills for this condition. Why? Because it's got a natural estrogen in it, and it's also got a progesterone that doesn't create the depression. a whole lot of other pills can make women feel worse. And don't be misled, the women who are listening to this out there, by having an IUD, that's an intrauterine device that produces progesterone, with thinking because it's in the uterus that therefore it's not going to affect the brain. That's wrong thinking, because of course the whole body is connected by the same blood system. So for a long time there was this nonsense talked about that, you know, oh, it's all contained in the uterus, don't worry about it, it won't cause any brain effects. That's not so. The sensitive woman, now this is not everybody, this is the group who are sensitive to their hormone fluctuations, are going to find that these manipulations, synthetic or natural, the fluctuations can set off a full-on depression with rage, tearfulness, poor energy, brain fog, and worst is suicidal thinking, aggressiveness, hostility, and completing suicide, the biggest tragedy. So
that's a small subset of that 12 to 25%. There's a sensitive.
Yeah. Well, no, we think all of the women in that 12 to 25% are somehow sensitive in terms of they're vulnerable for brain reactions to fluctuations in their hormones. All women who are having a cycle are having fluctuations of the hormones in their brain as well as their body, but about 25% will really react adversely to that.
Okay. So, you know, quite a large number. Still quite a large number.
It is quite a large number. And so we're doing more work to say why. You know, who are these women that get this worse condition of PMDD? And I've got to say, we've got some very strong clues that suggest that the women who've had early life traumas, and these are traumas of the most broad nature, that's emotional invalidation, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. Women who've experienced these things are much more likely to get PMDD. And we think that early life trauma creates a shift in the cortisol and brain hormone chemistry from a very young age, which then gets translated into making them more vulnerable to the gonadal hormone fluctuations. So that's a theory that we're testing at the moment, but it holds true in the clinical populations. Although women can get PMDD even with the loveliest of nurturing and caring early lives as well. So there are X factors. There is a genetic factor that's been isolated. And that was only isolated about 2 years ago, a specific PMDD gene. And so we know that some families, unfortunately, the women in the family carry this particular gene. But like many things, you can carry the PMDD gene and it's not expressed and you don't have PMDD until there is a trauma. And so sometimes we even see this in post-childbirth. If there's a traumatic childbirth, the woman after that childbirth and after she's, you know, had the baby and finished breastfeeding and all the rest of it, it will develop PMDD from then on. And so that was the trauma then, you know, was the actual trauma of childbirth. And there is a lot of trauma with childbirth, and we must never underestimate that, even though, you know, there's a lovely product of a hopefully healthy baby at the end, but there's trauma getting there for many women. So the PMDD gene is isolated. It's there. And we also need to be cognizant of early life trauma in causing brain changes, which then result in things like PMDD.
And so, what's the correlation at the moment with the, I mean, you mentioned quite a number of different parts of trauma, some being obviously sexual and physical. You also mentioned being invalidated in early life as well. Is there a correlation that we're kind of working with at the moment around that, or it's still being investigated?
We're still investigating it, but in the clinical sense, it's becoming quite clear that I would say, and again, I have a self-selected population because they're coming to a psychiatrist, tertiary help, so they've tried other things. But in that population that I'm seeing, I would say about 80% of the women I see, 80%, very high percentage, would have some early life something not nice. And so emotional invalidation is pretty powerful, as you would know. You know, we see the effects of that lifelong, unless it gets addressed in psychotherapy or other holistic sort of methods to cope with emotional invalidation or emotional abuse or any of the traumas that occur in childhood. So, and trauma, of course, affects the brain and body. So, you know, we always think about trauma as having psychological impacts, which it does, but we've got to also think about the other impacts that also occur from trauma. So, but this is another important factor in working with women with PMDD, that our good friends, trauma therapists, can actually do some wonders for PMDD management as well.
Do we have any data on PMDD rates in other countries where we know, for example, an entire country has been through war, where we would expect the trauma would be much more prevalent, in addition to obviously the sexual, physical, where, you know, we understand that, but on top of that, there's an overlay of fractured families, which probably does make people more vulnerable, and death, and, you know, scarcity of resources. You know, the anxiety levels must be certainly through the roof, and you know, your stress hormones must be immense, particularly, you know, even in child rearing and even when developing and when pregnant. Is there anything, at least in these early stages, that is showing differences in countries as well, or like where you know, very serious things have occurred?
I'm afraid that it's a very young field, and so the data that we get on PMDD is very much Western centric. So there is data coming from, obviously, from Australia, but also from the UK and the US. But I would imagine that there would be very pronounced PMDD in places, as you describe, where there are just awful things going on. But unfortunately, I think a lot of those situations, people get focused on the life and death type conditions. And this condition, as I say, is still in the early days of recognition. I mean, it took a long, long time to even get it into the recognition in the DSM system, the American classification system. And we still haven't got, you know, many times the woman will go to a general practitioner, even in this a wealthy country, and be told no, there's no such thing. It's in your brain. It's just, you know, you're making it up, which is terribly invalidating, of course. Actually, it is in her brain. I mean, that's a silly thing many people say, but you know, we haven't got to the point where we've got mental health clinicians and other clinicians thinking about the connection between hormone fluctuation and mental ill health. And that's a problem right across the board when you even think about menopause and other hormone fluctuations, post-childbirth and so on. So that's
sadly, I think that happens quite often across the board when we run out of ideas, we can't recognize something, we're not sure, rather than saying, I believe your experience, that is true, you're telling me that, I've got no reason why I would not believe you, but rather than saying, I don't have an understanding or reason why, we can sometimes be dismissive and say, oh, it's just in your head.
Yeah.
You know, and that's problematic for lots of things, whether it's chronic pain or other conditions like, you know, particularly gastro type problems like, you know, IBS as a great example. You know, it's just in your head. We get lots of that. So sadly, this one probably falls under that banner as well.
It does, very sadly, and particularly sadly because there are solutions. Like I said, you know, we use this particular contraceptive pill that's mood neutral, which is Zoli, quite a lot, and we see some brilliant turnarounds. So that makes me really sad because there are things that can be done. You know, it's awful when people have conditions that affect their life, but you haven't got anything really to offer. You know, there are some conditions like that, but this isn't one of those. You know, this is a condition that does affect women's lives badly, but we have solutions. It's just about then getting those solutions out there, which is about educating the mental health population, the clinicians, as well as the physical health clinicians. So, you know, podcasts like this, I'm very grateful for, because it is about trying to get that information out there.
And is something like Zoli taken maybe during that time of the month when someone is affected mostly, or is it, you know, kind of anticipating, or is it a dose?
It's the pill. So it's basically taken every day.
Okay.
Just like women take, it is a contraceptive pill. So it's exactly.
Okay. So it's just purely, but it's a particular one.
Yeah. It's a particular contraceptive pill that it's taken every day. There are 4 days in the packet that are sugar pills, and women take that to have a fake period. So it's not a real period when the sugar pills are taken during the 4 days. So there's 24 days of hormone, 4 days of sugar pill. Sometimes we do things like we say, okay, why don't you take just the active hormone tablets, skip the sugar pills, go to the next packet of active. The reason that we're doing this is because what we're trying to do is flatten the hormone fluctuation cycle, rather than going, you know, very high estrogen one part and then low in another part. The brain doesn't like the fluctuations. The brain, it works on a more moderate sort of flatter, steady state. And so that's what we're trying to get. And that's what the pills do. They create a steadier state of hormones in the brain, and that actually helps the mental health of the patient. So that's the idea behind it. Yes, it is a daily pill. And, of course, for women who are wanting to become pregnant, they can't take this because it is a contraceptive pill.
And can you talk me, and maybe we're not finished with the PM, or certainly not finished with the PMDD, because we could talk for hours, but can you tell me a little bit about the PME
yes.
side, the exacerbation side, the, you know, premenstrual exacerbation?
Yeah, so this applies for women who have an existing mental ill health condition, and that can be any existing ill health condition. So this is a woman who has, maybe she's got major depression, maybe she even has schizophrenia, or she has true bipolar, whatever, that they all get worse in the week preceding menstruation. So what we know is about the hormones that, in fact, estrogen in particular is what's called a neuroprotective hormone, so brain protective hormone. So it's actually doing things in the brain that stabilize the chemistry, stabilize the brain circuits. And it's a very protective or positive hormone for mental health. And so in the menstrual cycle, there are phases when the estrogen levels are low, and that's just prior to the woman having a period. And then it's almost as if the protection or the nice, lovely, positive aspects of estrogen are removed because there's less estrogen, and then the mental state goes haywire. So that's why many women who have an existing condition will also deteriorate in the 1 week or 7 days or 10 days prior to having a menstrual bleed. And then again, they too come back to their previous state once they start to have a bleed, or once the estrogen levels start to climb up again. So this is why many times, you know, take the woman with schizophrenia, for example, a very significant mental ill health condition. We know that many women have more admissions in the pre-menstrual phase because this is the time of the cycle when she's more at risk of the symptoms going haywire. So again, in this group of women with PME, premenstrual exacerbation of whatever the underlying underlying mental ill health condition, the rationale to try and stabilize the brain hormones is a good one. So we can use the contraceptive pill or forms of hormone therapy like you would give menopausal women to stabilize the fluctuations and to improve the levels or to increase the levels of brain estrogen, because brain estrogen is good. You know, it's a very simplistic model, but, you know, it's basically saying that estrogen is a good hormone for brain health. which is not something we would normally think about. You know, estrogen is the girl's hormone that controls reproduction and fertility. And yes, it does have those roles, but in the brain, it's got potent roles for mental health. So this is another descriptor, because many times people say things like, well, I don't actually get significantly depressed. I don't have the brain fog that you describe, or the rage or the depression, but I kind of, you know, have this low-level depression that just gets worse. Or I have, you know, other things where the voices that I hear just gets worse. So it's important to recognize that the menstrual cycle, or the hormones of the menstrual cycle, have lots of different functions and roles.
And is it the same approach, assuming that we're still talking about a hormone issue, that we would still be going back to a Zoli type approach to try and flatten out the fluctuations, so that if someone already has a pre-existing condition, rather than there's an onset of dysregulation, so to speak, it's flattened out, and therefore they don't feel as much of a fluctuation.
Correct.
During that Correct. Time, that's
yeah. Okay. It's going back to that, as you say, the first principles of trying to actually get control for the woman over her hormonal fluctuations, because it's in the fluctuations that her mental health is worsening. We do use Zoli in the probably the younger age group, and by the time women get to their early 40s, we then start to think about the menopause process, which is kind of like PMDD times 40. It's the same set of symptoms, but just really amped up. And in the mid-40s, that's when menopause begins, and it begins in the brain. And it's exactly the same sensitivity to hormones, and it then becomes a full-on mental ill health condition. And, of course, the cycle is she's losing the cycle, because she's going into the menopause when there is no cycle, which means that these symptoms are now not just contained to 7 to 10 days, but they can be right across every day. That's what we talk about, the amplification of the PMDD. And certainly women who have PMDD are more likely to have a bad menopause when they get to the mid-40s, and then late 40s, and then early 50s. But again, hormone therapies are available and they work. The only thing is, you know, there's a few physical health issues that have to be signed off on before women can start these hormone treatments that are pretty basic. I mean, it's like you wouldn't be giving hormone treatment to somebody who has breast cancer, or who has a very strong family history of breast cancer, or someone who's had a blood clotting disorder recently. They're about the main things. We don't like giving oral contraceptive pills to women who smoke cigarettes, because that can cause clotting, you know, blood clots in the leg or in the lung. But usually most, you know, women can take a hormone contraceptive. And, you know, when you talk to the woman to get the lived experience in all of this, she'll often appreciate a much better targeted treatment view with hormones. As one of my patients had said, it's obvious.
And in terms of dosage, is that something that is looked at from a prescriptive perspective, that different women respond differently to different dosages? Is there a general understanding of what that looks like in terms of, for most women, how does that usually start?
You would think that would be the case. And, you know, in the ideal world, yes, that would be very much, but it's not. So, for example, with the pill, they're all set, pretty set. You know, it's one pill a day. It has, if we looked at Zoli, it has 30 micrograms of the estradiol. That's it. It's set. When it comes to the older women who are in their early 40s, mid 40s, and so on, then there is a possibility of playing with the dosing, which I like the woman to do herself, so that she helps, you know, well, she's running a titration of dose because she's in the best possible position to do that. So there are different types of hormones and different doses there, but not so much with the pill. The pill is just set. Although
it's interesting because maybe because my apologies for jumping. It's interesting because maybe the pill requires a certain dose from a contraceptive perspective.
Yes, that's right.
But it's being used for a different reason that you and I are talking about.
Yes.
The application hasn't changed in terms of being able to offer different doses.
Correct.
Having said that, I'm not sure whether as a psychiatrist you can change that dose or prescribe that dose in terms of, you know, doubling a dose or whether those doses can even be broken in half. I'm not sure. I don't assume so. Is that something that the research is looking at, or that's future to come?
So we're looking at it in terms of, no, you can't do much with the pill because it's this tiny little pill and it's just set. You know, there's just sure. a set dose and that's it. But what we do in our clinic, for example, is we start the woman on the Zoli who's got PMDD, and she'll come back in a couple of months' time and say, often the story is, oh, look, I'm better, but I'm like 60% better or 70% better. I still, the last two cycles, I've still dipped in my mood. It's not as bad as it was, but it's still there. So then we get the what that's saying is we're on the right track, but we're not quite there yet. So what we'll then do is add a little bit more estrogen, and we might use a patch or something like that to actually increase the dose of estrogen on top of the pill, but making sure that she's physically well and that there are no physical contraindications to doing this. But this is still very early days. You know, the clinical trials are not there because the clinical trials have always focused on antidepressant treatment for depression and kind of been a bit of a blunt treatment tool without really being finessing the cause of the particular depression. And this depression is different to a standard major depression that occurs in men, that occurs in, it occurs in women as well. But you know, this story of the cyclical deterioration is a different cause. So I think we've got to get better in having a more personalized, individualized approach for depression, and not everything is about antidepressants.
Mm-hmm. And what are being something that is quite new, or certainly new to me, and I assume it's probably new to many others as well. What are some of the criticisms that you've faced in looking at this?
Have you got 3 years? So a lot of criticisms, because it's funny, it's from very conservative physician endocrinology group who get worried about stepping outside guidelines. And it's almost, the criticism is, you're a psychiatrist, what are you doing swimming in our lane? You know, go back and swim in your own lane, which is use antidepressants, use mood stabilizers, but what are you doing dabbling with hormones? So there can be that criticism. And medicine is, look, it has the good bits of evidence-based medicine is that it tries to cut out the, you know, odd charlatan type practices. And if you're going to particularly provide a new treatment, then it needs to be safe, it needs to be directed, and so on. So there are those concerns that we haven't got the big worldwide trials to show that hormone strategies work in PMDD. We're trying to get the funding to do that, but funding is always difficult in women's mental health. So that is one criticism that's made by very, very conservative physicians about that. The other criticism that's made is, well, you know, it's all very waffly. And this is part of the problem of mental health or psychiatry. There is a soft, squishy, waffly bit. You know, we can't get the hard sort of very clear definitions. You know, look at what we've just been talking about. There's PMS, there's PMDD, there's PME, and it's very hard. You know, when you're doing a clinical trial with a heart attack, you've got your ECG, there are the changes, here's your new treatment, and you watch what happens. It's very definitive. But here, You know, we have women who would not necessarily fall exactly into the DSM classification of PMDD, but you just know from her story that this is a factor. It's a big factor causing it. So we have that sort of criticism that, you know, we're dealing with the grey, if you like. We're not always dealing in the black and white, which is difficult when you're trying to get an evidence base. The other big criticism that's been levelled a long time, and it's kind of led to this denial, is the sense of you deal with hormones because of body issues. It's the ovaries, it's the uterus. What are you doing talking about the brain? You know, we don't really believe that the hormones have got much to do with the brain. And there's a weird sort of separation of different bits of the body, and different specialists will only deal with certain bits. But, you know, something like PMDD is a whole woman thing. And as I said, you know, there's a PMDD gene that you mix with the trauma that then brings out PMDD, which is not necessarily defined as strictly as the 7 to 10 days prior to menstruation. So there's a few different bits that we have in there to look at. And the fourth bit, I can go on, but the fourth bit is women's mental health, poor funding, terrible resourcing, very poorly understood. And I still get criticisms. Well, why do you think it's different to men's mental health? You know, what's the big deal here? So even at that fundamental level, we have to make the case for thinking about women with depression differently, and then, you know, trying to improve their outcome. So there are lots of criticisms, some of which I think we're getting beyond, but some of which are still holding us back.
It's a real challenge, I think, in all of psychology and psychiatry. We try and understand what are the clinical thresholds and how to describe them. You know, we all know that hormones play an effect on human lives, emotions, feelings, etc. Most parents understand that, you know, when their children go into teenagehood. But we also, you know, experience it in our own lives, and that challenge of finding out what is the threshold. And, you know, we know in the DSM in particular, there's that real difficult understanding criteria of, you know, what is clinical impairment? How do we agree on what clinical impairment is? You know, for ADHD, you know, some will argue that if you are upholding a job, the clinical impairment can't be there, at least at the level to call it ADHD. Others will say you would have performed better, and so it's having an effect. And so that debate runs on. It sounds like there's going to be that challenge as well in this space, because, you know, even those three categories that we first spoke about, the PMS, which, you know, 80% the population, female reproductive population, are experiencing. Everyone gets it. No one's debating whether that's occurring,
yep,
or not. But the threshold of it going to whether it's PME, and that there was an exacerbation of a pre-existing condition, or, you know, PMDD, where there wasn't a pre-existing and you know, a depression occurs very rapidly, you know, onset and offset, so to speak. It's important to have these conversations, and I like the fact that it can be debated, because I think it asks both sides to come forward and demonstrate an argument, and therefore it poses research questions. You know, it says,
yes,
how do
yes.
we actually, you know, for the endocrinologists are concerned, fantastic, they've got something to look at, and so do the psychiatrists and, you know, other medicine as well. It's an important one that we all do together, because there's no doubt that hormones make a difference. You know, if we look at it from a men's perspective, I believe that 40 onwards for men, testosterone starts to drop, and I believe there's an appreciation that, you know, for men, 40 onwards is a difficult period of time for all sorts of reasons. You know, it's difficult to do controls, but once again, this conversation leads to, you know, the men's health as well, and obviously might talk to another expert in that space, but it's no doubt that this is going on. The question is just, how do we help people? You know, what do we do? It's not a debate about whether it's happening or not. At least for me, it's not.
It's not it's not for us, but there are still people who debate that, and particularly women, I think, are often given that invalidating statement by a whole range of people, including, you know, the practitioners and so on, and that's got to stop. You know, like you said, that comment about, oh no, that couldn't possibly be happening. Well, it is happening, so, you know, deal with it better. It would be the education for our practitioner colleagues. But I think in the end, what we're trying to do is say, look, here's a whole palette of different treatments that are available for this very pronounced and debilitating condition. So please do a co-designed, collaborative management discussion with the person who is suffering with the condition so that you come up with something that fits. And it could be hormones plus an antidepressant, or it could be just antidepressants, or it could be just hormones, or it could be psychotherapy and nothing else, or, you know, like there's quite a few different things that could be used. But that's where we need to head, so that we end up with a holistic approach for each individual. And we also understand that depression is not just a blanket thing. There are very different conditions that can appear under the umbrella of depression. For example.
Absolutely. For our listeners who would like to follow up and read more, find out more, the research, any websites, books, articles that you could recommend, how they might even get in touch with yourself.
So we have our website, which is Her Center website, and that is Monash University, Her Centre Australia. So I can forward that to you to put on your program. So that's a website there. We also have a women's mental health short course that is also available through the Her Centre website. So I guess if I send you the details for that, that's probably the best thing to do.
And we can certainly put that on our podcast as well, so that the show notes have those links available. Thank you so much for your time today. Pleasure. and shining a light on this space. It's certainly not something that I've known much about at all, and I feel much more informed, at least in the scaffolding. Plenty more to try and, you know, read up on and learn and hear different sides, and also to look out for with my clients as well. So really do appreciate your time and you know, your efforts in this space, and, you know, thank you for sharing today.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your interest in this topic. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listeners. So thank you.